Hi, you're listening to the Yale Anesthesiology Podcast. Make sure to visit our show website so that you can take advantage of the links of the papers that will be mentioned during this recording. Thank you for listening. Hi, I'm Antonio Gonzalez, and I'm thrilled to present our next guest. Dr. Tom Klumpner is a fellowship-trained obstetric anesthesiologist and clinical informaticist. He specializes in anesthesia for high-risk obstetrics and clinical decision support. Dr. Klumpner's research interests involve using technology to detect complications of childbirth before they become life-threatening. He spearheaded a multidisciplinary effort at the University of Michigan to develop an automatic electronic maternal early warning system. He also serves as the Assistant Director of Informatics and System Improvement for the Department of Anesthesiology, where he uses his expertise with computer programming and web development to improve the care of patients within the health system. He is here today to discuss his article, Use of a Novel Electronic Maternal Surveillance System and the Maternal Early Warning Criteria to Detect Severe Postpartum Hemorrhage. Dr. Klumpner, welcome to our podcast.
Antonio, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the elephant in the room. As an anesthesiologist, how do you become a creator of an algorithm or a maternal surveillance system like this?
Yeah, no, I guess I would say I'm a big computer nerd, right? And so that's probably one of my defining characteristics, for better or worse. And so when I joined the faculty at University of Michigan sometime around 2015, I think my colleagues picked up on this pretty quickly. And this meant that I could get involved in a lot of different projects for the department, including within our OB anesthesia division. I'm an obstetric anesthesiologist, right? And so I got involved in a lot of the QA work early on, particularly the QA work that involved potential electronic solutions. And so one of the projects I got pulled into early on was this near-miss event that we had sometime in 2015. You know, basically this was a healthy mom that had delivered in a labor and delivery room and unfortunately had a delivery that was complicated by really severe postpartum hemorrhage. And she just kept bleeding and bleeding. You know, eventually, you know, her systolic blood pressure was less than 60 for over 30 minutes. This was, you know, the cup was cycling. There were a lot of smart people in the room. And so I think the group, when looking at this event, sort of said, you know, geez, you know, what if a page had gone out for that first systolic less than 65? So I guess taking a couple of steps back, right, we had a written early notification pathway for an entire labor and delivery unit that was modeled after the maternal early warning criteria. This was something that Jill Meyer published in 2014, right? And around that time, Jill was actually part of our division. Problem with this, though, was that these written criteria were actually a little bit complicated. Not the maternal early warning criteria, but the early warning criteria that we modeled after Jill Meyer's criteria at University of Michigan was actually quite complicated. We have a lot of different services, right? So we have family medicine, we have obstetricians, we have a number of services, and they all have different notification pathways. And I think there's also a human component to this as well, right? There's a bit of, once you see an aberrant vital sign, are you actually going to be able to notify someone else that something's going wrong? So when I got pulled into this project, I actually thought, why not? Why can't, you know, geez, if you had just paged, you know, maybe you would have gotten someone else in the room that says we should move to the operating room. And so I thought this was fantastic, right? And so just a little bit of context, we have a unit with about 50 beds. And 34 at the time, there were 34 beds that were connected to network monitors that would have been capable of automatic paging. And actually, you know, it was kind of new at this, so I was really worried that whatever we built might not work. So I said, okay, let's build this out. We'll set the pages to go off largely the maternal early warning criteria. But before you turn this on, send this to my personal pager. And oh my God, my pager like blew up. By the end of the day, I was like, what do we do with this? This was just like totally unexpected. And so, you know, I think I knew after this that we needed something that was a little bit more sophisticated than just paging whenever you have a bedside monitor that picks up an abnormal vital sign. And so, you know, I feel like I was lucky. I felt like I was in a maybe the right place, the right time. So the chair of our department at that time, Dr. Kevin Tremper, was also the founder of this medical device company called AlertWatch, right? And so I think at least our institution was well positioned from an infrastructure perspective in terms of having all of the equipment set up. But AlertWatch as a company was also willing to build us a prototype for free, which worked out, I think, really well for us.
That is amazing. And I think that, you know, there are a couple of things that we are probably going to be touching throughout the podcast, but I want to highlight them just now. So one of them is that about 40% of maternal deaths are considered to be preventable. And what we mean by that is that sometimes we actually just don't seem to get to these patients quick enough, right? So having a system in place to get the provider's bedside seems to be key. Now, the other problem and the caveat to having a system like this is, like, as you mentioned, is the possibility of alarm fatigue. So we'll probably be touching a bit up on that. And by alarm fatigue is, like, you know, as you mentioned, those pages going off every 9 minutes. So that could have been exhausting. And at some point, you just stop paying attention to those pages.
Right. And just, if I could, just taking a couple steps back, right? Our role as anesthesiologists, the role in our role, I think, you know, this is my opinion, I think shared by a lot of others, is that it's a team sport. OB is a team sport, right? And you know, the obstetric anesthesia team could be consulted for, at least in our case, we have 50 beds. You know, I could get consulted on any of those 50 patients, right? And so it's to our patient's best interest if every team member is actively involved in the surveillance of patient vital signs, right? You know, and if you look at it selfishly, like from my perspective, if I know about that patient sooner, right, because of a vital sign aberrancy that gets picked up before the formal call for help, if you will, comes out, right? I can start preparing. I can start taking the brakes off the hemorrhage cart and kind of wheeling it in that direction, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. It makes absolutely a lot of sense. So what is exactly this electronic maternal surveillance system? Is it an algorithm, or this is artificial intelligence, a combination of both?
Yeah, no, I think saying it's artificial intelligence is many steps too far. You know, this is a pretty simple system, I think, in terms of complexity, what computers can handle, right? So, you know, this thing is just algorithm driven. It's basically something that we give the system a set of thresholds, like a heart rate greater than 130, a systolic less than 85, shock index, which we could talk about later if you want. We start with that set of parameters and then say, if you have one of these parameters, page the bedside nurse first. So we use the bedside nurse sort of as a first responder. And then if there's a second set of abnormal vital signs, so let's say the first blood pressure is 80 systolic, nurse gets a page, checks the patient again, the computer sees a second set of vitals, let's say it's 78 systolic, right? Then right away, the system will figure out who the appropriate managing service is based on criteria that we coded, right? And then it sends that page to the managing service. And so, you know, it's not using anything more fancy than that, really, right? And there's going to be some pages that go to the managing service without nurse verification. These are things like lab abnormalities that we set in the system. And then we sort of have a pop-off valve, if you will. If the nurse, you know, the pager batteries are gone, or didn't bring the pager for whatever reason, or if they're busy, there's a time limit. It's 30 minutes. So if no one has rechecked vitals in 30 minutes, then the page just goes to the managing service.
So another question that I have here, so this being an algorithm, is race included as part of the algorithm?
No. This is really just based, we base this off of objective criteria, mainly from the maternal early warning criteria. And so race was not included in the maternal early warning criteria, you know, and that was not part of the build.
Yeah, I think that overall, that probably is a great idea not to include race in most of our algorithms, because they then increase the possibility of implicit bias. And as you know, from our history, in, for example, the TOLAC scores, we know that race has been a contributor to decreasing somewhat arbitrarily the scores of the patients, particularly our Black patient population.
Agree. I think another advantage, if I may, another advantage then, I guess, of an electronic system like this too, right, is it's just objective. If you get a page for these criteria, right, the criteria did not involve race, the patient should be evaluated. And in that sense, it removes a bit of any existing, you know, cognitive biases or unconscious biases that might exist.
You already mentioned a little bit about what you use for as triggering events. Would you give us a little bit more information about your triggering events?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, just taking a step back, right? So the maternal early warning criteria includes triggers for systolic blood pressure, so hypertension. So we used greater than 160 systolic, greater than 110 diastolic. Maternal early warning criteria includes heart rate greater than 120. We actually bumped it up to 130 after feedback. It also includes respiratory rate, but we didn't end up including that. I can go into that if you like. Maternal early warning criteria also includes pulse oximetry. An early version of the software started with pulse oximetry. You know, SpO2 less than 95 would generate a page, but you know, for example, if you wiggle your finger a little too much, it starts to go towards 85, and so those pages were driving people nuts. I think the criteria included heart rate less than 50. We ended up getting rid of that, again, based on user feedback as well. You know, this was an iterative process. We started with the maternal early warning criteria. You know, heart rate 120 is a great example of the work we did here. Pulse ox less than 80, 95 is another example of the work. The initial prototype started as close to the maternal early warning criteria as possible, you know, excluding, of course, the maternal early warning criteria includes these other criteria like maternal agitation, confusion, unresponsiveness. We couldn't really capture that well electronically, but just looking at those threshold criteria. And then every week or so, we met as a multidisciplinary group. We had a couple of obstetricians. We had nursing leadership. We had midwifery involved. We invited someone from family medicine to come. So we really tried to get as many people as possible, especially the folks that were getting the pages, to be able to voice their complaints about the system. And so that's basically how we ended up tweaking it. You know, and interestingly, one of the early complaints was, you know, when a mother's pushing, everyone gets everyone gets kind of tachycardic. Everyone gets a little hypertensive, you know. And so we ended up suppressing pages during stage two of labor for that reason as well, you know, partly because of that reported artifact, but also because we knew that there was going to be someone in the room the entire time.
It seems like this system was actually created with a lot of input from nursing and obstetricians. So it sounds like a great system. And we've been talking a little bit about maternal early warning signs, but for the benefit of the audience, would you please introduce this concept to them?
Yeah, no, I think just an early warning system is basically something that's designed to detect a problem, you know, sooner, I guess, if you will. It's almost like a screening criteria. And so I guess aside from a set of triggers that should really like prompt a maternal evaluation, I sort of think of it as being multiple parts, right? It's not a maternal early warning system in a way. It's not just a set of vital sign thresholds that should get you to take a look at your patient, but it's really a unit-wide team approach to management of these obstetric patients, right? And so that means it involves patient monitoring, you know, good amount of vigilance, identification of trigger vital signs, and that when these trigger vital signs are detected, typically by the bedside nurse, the expectation is that notification occurs to the managing service, and that an evaluation takes place in response to that evaluation. Then it's sort of a cycle. It just keeps going. We monitor, we alert, we evaluate, we respond. And this ongoing cycle of continuous vigilance, monitoring, surveillance, alerting, responding continues on and on and on while the patient stays. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. And the maternal early warning criteria was key. But as you mentioned, it needs to be tweaked for it to be actually beneficial. Otherwise, we end up running into the problem of alarm fatigue, which is what you probably experienced, you know, by 2018 when you published your initial experience of tweaking the software. You've been working already 2 years with the software. Please share with the audience your experience in those 2 years of tweaking the software.
Yeah. So I guess in particular, in response to alarm fatigue, I think that misery loves company, I guess. And so like having this multidisciplinary team that we could all come together and complain about the different paging criteria that we had all decided on a couple weeks later was really very important, right? And I think this was like a super important part of the overall design process, which was, you know, we all work on the unit together. We all get the pages together. And then so when we realized something was not quite right, or they were just getting really irritating, right, we had the ability to tweak it, and tweak it quickly, right? We could tweak it for the next week, so that when we were all again on call, we could sort of figure out, was this something that we wanted to keep using and how we were going to tweak it, right? So I already talked about the pulse ox changes, the changes with pushing and things like that. I think another piece of this that we wanted to capture was, How do we get the opinion of everyone else that isn't part of these meetings, right? And so part of that, too, was we ended up sending out this anonymous unit survey, and the majority of people felt they wanted to continue using the system. I mean, the first question on the survey was point blank, should we continue to use this on our unit? And 83% of respondents wanted to continue to use the system. But 51% of people that responded to the survey said they were getting paged too frequently. And then we also allowed people to give their own sort of just anonymous written feedback. And so some of those responses were actually really enlightening. You know, there were people that were supportive of the system, right? So there was a nurse that had said, this is their quote, "Also, there have been instances where I didn't think a vital sign value was significant, but have been met by an MD, you know, OB or anesthesiology in the room who felt that the vital sign change was important when it actually was important, but I hadn't put it together yet that it mattered, right? And so that made me feel like we were on a good path, but there were also a couple that were like, oh, geez, you know, this is, what am I going to do with these quotes? Trust me, if there's any doubt about whether or not I need anesthesiology and or OB in the room, I will call pronto. Just like the meows thing was a giant waste of time and money, so is this. Oh my God, right? There was another one. The nurse is the eyes and ears at the bedside, not the machine or computer. And then there was one from an OB faculty that literally said, "I have turned my personal pager off during the call nights so as not to be unnecessarily interrupted." Right. So this stuff was eye opening to me, because I, you know, initially you think you have an 83% of people want to keep using the system, but there is this other component of it too, which is hard for me to dissect. And these opinions are really very valuable, because you don't want people to be ignoring the pages, right? Like that would, or you also don't want to create a culture where all of a sudden you question the utility of your early warning system. And it speaks to the complexity of this problem of alarm fatigue, right? I mean, alarm frequency is just one piece of it. A lot of the papers we focused on the frequency of the pages as a surrogate of alarm fatigue, right? But the context in which you get a page is probably super important, right? If you're dead asleep in the middle of the night and you get an AWOB page for like a heart rate of 133, but it turns out it was because, you know, the patient was wiggling their finger and the pulse ox registered twice the value of their heart rate, you're going to get pretty mad. And alarm accuracy is important. You know, there's some studies that suggest perhaps you tend to respond close to the rate at which the alarm is accurate, right? So if you know that the alarm is going to be 100% accurate, you're going to drop everything and respond to it, depending on what it's notifying you for. And so you know, it was sort of interesting. I think you'll ask about another study where we looked at, you know, how accurate actually are these pages. the pages, it turns out, have a positive predictive value of close to 5% for prediction of at least severely morbid postpartum hemorrhage. And so, yeah, I think there's probably still some room for improvement here. Definitely. I mean, like the survey says more than half of people say they get paged too much. There's some people in the survey, I think it's a really small amount, but it, not an insignificant amount, and that say like this is making me, you know, I don't trust this thing. Like this is crazy. So I think it definitely says there's room for improvement. Nothing is perfect.
Yeah, no, but I think that what I think was actually very good about these survey that you sent out and actually published, right? You didn't only kept the survey to yourself. You actually put out the survey. And I think it gives the audience a lot of perspective, or the reader, a lot of perspective about, like, you know, most of the time we just hear the happy stories, like, oh, this software was a success. But nobody hears the process of getting that software from the beginning points to actually a successful app or a successful software, right? So I think it speaks volume about the honesty of creating this software. So I really thank you for putting it out there and showing us the process, because it shows that you care about what people are saying, and it seems like you're already improving it. So one of the things that you did to improve it was to actually have nurses corroborate some of these information, right? How did that improve? You at the beginning said that you were getting pages every 10 minutes. When the nurses started putting in on corroborating data, how did that affect the amount of pages that you were getting?
Dramatically, right? So, but the hard part is it was part of a bundle of changes. So we didn't necessarily look at what is the role of having the nurse as a first, you know, first responder, how does that affect it? But when you combine nurses as a first responder, when you get rid of pages during the second stage of labor, when you get rid of the pulse ox criteria, when you get rid of the bradycardia, when you move heart rate from 120 to 130, when you make some other minor adjustments to the notifications, you go from about one page every 9 to 10 minutes, depending on how you measure it. I think it was to one page every 3 hours or so for the managing service, right? And that, and just looking at the individual nurse's paging burden, the individual nurse's paging burden is actually really very low, especially if they only have a couple of patients that page. And if they're, of course, they might have a high-risk patient, and then that sort of throws this discussion out the window. But on average, the paging frequency to an individual nurse is very low. And I just want to go back and respond to your previous question. So thank you so much. I think it's super important to have transparency, obviously, in what you do. But for me, it's also a plea for help. You know, these were expert consensus vital signs. I just felt like, you know, this is such a complicated thing. And it intersects with so many complicated issues. And I don't have really good answers to this. You know, I can keep plugging along and tweaking it and seeing what my measurements look like. But I think, you know, especially as folks are, as we as a health, you know, in healthcare get more experience with AI and things like that, I wonder if there's utility in involving folks with expertise in that, in this process. How do you design a better early warning system?
Yeah, it seems like already your tweaks are working, because, you know, from going to 10 minutes, every 10 minutes to every 3 hours, that's actually a reasonable compromise. Now, as part of the algorithm, I guess your team needed to adjust, and you've mentioned a little bit about this throughout the podcast already, that you had to adjust the parameters to account for the physiology of pregnancy, right? So the physiology of pregnancy changes throughout the process, you know, during labor, immediately postpartum. So tell us a little bit about that experience and how you incorporated these physiologic changes of pregnancy into the system.
Yeah, so we really just used the maternal early warning criteria, which was based off of expert consensus. And I wasn't part of it, obviously, but, it, you know, you would assume that the expert consensus group took into account the changes of pregnancy, right? I think part of that too is we know tachycardia is, your heart rate's going to increase when in pregnancy. And so I think it naturally made sense for us to increase the paging threshold from 120 to 130. You know, we also tried to account for systolic blood pressure changes, right? So we actually lowered the systolic notification threshold to 85 and things like that. But, you know, I wish I could say it was informed by a very careful review of the literature and a full understanding of the physiologic changes of pregnancy, but it was really informed by our practical efforts to tweak the system every couple of weeks, every few weeks, in response to what we felt would be useful changes for all of us that were at the table.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that was actually very impressive from reading one of your papers was that the system also offers a visual way of seeing how each one of your patients is doing. Would you please briefly tell us a little bit about this visualization system?
Yeah, no, 100%. And in fact, I think, and I thank you for asking this question, right? Because I think this is a critical piece of this. So the surveillance system is actually two parts. It's the automated pages, which we've published a lot about. But there's this whole other piece that's really important, I think, which is this visualization system. And so the way the software works is it integrates a lot of patient information, not just vital signs. It takes vital signs from the bedside monitor, but it also combs through the patient problem lists, medical history, other codified data. We wrote a text parsing algorithm to go through some of the little sign-out notes that the obstetricians would leave along with the patient chart. It pulls in lab values. It pulls in flow sheet rows, depending on what some of the nurse documentation is. And so it can integrate all of this data into a visual system so that you can potentially improve situational awareness, right? And in this regard, I'm not speaking about evidence because we haven't studied that necessarily. I'm just speaking of my own personal experience using it. And so, for example, we have each patient, it's designed to show up on one screen. And so each patient is a box. And then we tied this with icons. So icons for severe preeclampsia with severe features, preeclampsia without severe features, icons for abnormal placentation, right? Risk factors for postpartum hemorrhage. We have an icon for the greatest IV size. So if you have a 16 gauge IV, it'll show 16. We also did a bit of color coding and arrangement of the boxes so that, you know, we have antepartum patients grouped a certain way. We have intrapartum patients grouped a certain way, patients that are pushing a certain way, and those that are postpartum. And so when you come into a call with a little bit of training to understand the icon system and everything else, you've got good situational awareness. And then we translated those paging alerts into little boxes that are in a consistent location on each. So, you know, you imagine your patient grid, you can have a little red square, for example, if the patient has a certain vital sign abnormality. And then if you see that square flashing, it's a flashing red square that lets you know that you're probably going to get a page on that person. And then we also have like a black box. And so what we did, right? So again, going back to that heart rate of 120, if someone has a heart rate above 120, we kept that as a black box. And so we can still say that through this visualization system, we're actually still potentially notifying a service for a vital sign abnormality meeting the maternal early warning criteria. And then it just gets, you can see the boxes change from there. We put this status board, if you will, up across the unit. So we've got one of these boards up in the anesthesia room. We've got a board up in the OB room. We've got it at a couple of nursing stations. And so what's really nice here, at least for me, is if you're near one of these boards and you get a page for, sustained hypotension, for example, you can look and say, oh yeah, that was the BMI 50 preeclamptic with severe features that for some reason now still only has a 20 gauge IV. Or you can look and say this, you know, this is a person that has a risk factors for postpartum hemorrhage. They have thrombocytopenia. It actually guides your response to that page when you get it. You can look up and say, yeah, actually, this is probably real. I'm going to go ahead and grab the hemorrhage cart and I will go to the room, right? Versus you can see, oh, I got a page for a heart rate of 133. She doesn't have any major risk factors for postpartum hemorrhage. She literally just delivered 5 minutes ago. I'm just going to casually walk by the room and make sure they're okay.
Yeah, I think the visualization icons were actually look pretty good in the paper. you know, as you tweak your system, right, it seems like you started getting a little bit more specific, right? And your publication 2020 was more geared toward postpartum hemorrhage. So what were you trying to prove with this 2020 publication in anesthesia and analgesia, the one about postpartum hemorrhage?
Yeah, so I guess, so the system, the origin point of this whole system was this, was to manage hemorrhage better on our unit, right? So the focal point, I mean, while the system is designed to notify for other maternal morbidity, the primary focus of the system was really on postpartum hemorrhage. And so we designed this retrospective study to determine the sensitivity and specificity of these automated pages for the detection of severely morbid postpartum hemorrhage. And so we defined severely morbid postpartum hemorrhage using previously published criteria. And so this included a hemorrhage that was complicated by operative management of the postpartum hemorrhage, or greater than four unit blood transfusion of red cells, greater than 2 units of red cells, and greater than 2 units of FFP, transfusion with less than 4 units of blood product and a dose of furosemide. Transfer to the ICU. So there were a number of these criteria that define severely morbid postpartum hemorrhage. And so then what we did was we took this objective criteria and we looked at deliveries between, you know, mid-2017 and winter of 2018, so about a year and a half period. And we found 120 of about 7,800, so 1.5% of our deliveries over that time period were complicated by severely morbid postpartum hemorrhage, and that the majority of these, most of them were detected because they went to the operating room for definitive management, but they were certainly very sick. There were a number that had many transfusions. There were a number that got transferred to the ICU. There were a number that ended up with hysterectomies, but the vast majority of them went for operative management of the hemorrhage. And so we defined a success then as if one of these 120 cases got one automated page to any provider within 24 hours of delivery. And then we just compared that to how the maternal early warning criteria would have performed. Long story short, we found that the automated pages had a sensitivity of about 61%, while the maternal early warning criteria had a sensitivity of close to 75%. The automated pages were more specific, so the positive predictive value for the automated pages was 5.1%, maternal early warning criteria 3.3, and this was statistically significant. But even though it was less sensitive, the automated pages ended up picking up 10 severely morbid postpartum hemorrhage cases that were not identified by the maternal early warning criteria. 6 of these were for anemia. That's not a surprise, right? The maternal early warning criteria doesn't include anemia, but there were 4 cases actually that were picked up by the software system because it detected vitals that were picked up by the bedside monitor, but not recorded by the nurse in the EHR, right? And so again, I just taking a step back, like how does something like this happen? I think you have to understand a little bit about the electronic documentation workflow. We're on Epic, right? And I'm sure other electronic health record vendors use a similar process, but you have a feed of data coming from a bedside monitor that is presented to the nurse or someone in the process for validation into the electronic health record. This allows the nurse to say, oh, no, you know, the cuff was cycling when it was off the patient, for example, somehow it registered a value. I don't want that to go in the patient's chart. So there is a process where the unvalidated vitals from the bedside monitor are presented to a nurse for validation before they're ultimately recorded in the electronic health record. But I think this finding was really worth highlighting, which is that the automated system actually picked up 4 additional hemorrhages because of vitals that were recorded by the bedside monitor, but had not been yet recorded in the, or had not ever been recorded actually in the electronic health record.
That is actually very interesting. And I mean, I think that we need to have a little bit of perspective, right? And you mentioned already a couple of important things here, but when we look at these positive predictive values of 5 or 3%, right? Definitely your system seems to be better than the plain muse, right? Or maternal early warning signs. But, you know, like if you were pitching me this software, I'll be like, I'm not really that interested because with that positive predictive value, you know, I'm not interested. But I know that there is more to it. So would you please talk to us a little bit more about these potential of these positive predictive values?
Yeah, no, 100%, right? So remember that we reported the positive predictive value. So if you get one of these pages, what is the chance that it's actually going to be a severely morbid hemorrhage? So it's about 1 in 20. So at the time, the data told us that if I got one of these pages from the system, there was a 1 in 20 chance that I'd be taking this patient essentially to the operating room to manage their hemorrhage, which is still significant. I think you also need to recognize, right, we didn't include non-morbid postpartum hemorrhage, and we also didn't include other things that could cause sustained tachycardia and hypotension, right? So you could have a bad hemorrhage that would cause sustained tachycardia and hypotension, probably responds to fluids, and maybe it stops. You got the anesthesia team into the room. But because we didn't drag them to the operating room to resuscitate them, or they didn't get more than 4 units of blood product, you know, 4 units of blood products, then they wouldn't have been included in this study. And worse, because the system would have sent a page, it would have been a false positive, at least in our study. But in my mind, that is definitely, you know, I go into the room, I manage the hemorrhage, but just because they didn't get 4 units of blood, it's a false positive. That's the lens through which you have to interpret this data, right? The value of this system is it can get extra. And not only does it not, it'll detect conditions that are not necessarily severely morbid postpartum hemorrhage, but it also gets extra people into the room that might have a unique perspective, right? So, and I think that's a really important part of this, which is that, you know, when you're involved in a crisis, and I think we've all experienced this, when something is just unfolding before your eyes and you have such a deep stake in what's going on, you have all these personal feelings of that interfere with your objectivity. These types of cognitive biases are just built into the way our brains work. Right. And I think that the nice thing about this is that the computer is cold and calculating. It doesn't care. It's going to wake you up. It doesn't care. It's the middle of the night. It's going to send you a page, and it might be wrong, but it doesn't care. It's going to send you the page anyway. Right. If you're trying to detect a preventable rare event, you do need to have a lot more false positives, and you need to be consistent in it. And I think that the computer really can aid you in that.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think it's very important to highlight these again, like what you've mentioned, and these cases highlight something that we've seen with, like, for example, quantitative blood measurements, and with the use of the point of care viscoelastic testing, right? And when you look at it, or you compare quantitative blood measurements versus estimated blood measurements, so point of care viscoelastic testing to the traditional postpartum hemorrhage management, it almost seems like there's no benefit there, because you're looking at the whole entire patient population that is experiencing hemorrhage, right? But if you really delve into the system, what you're actually probably missing is that, sure, you're not seeing the worst of the cases, because you were triggered into action earlier than you would have if you would not have a system in place. If you wouldn't have the point of care viscoelastic testing, you wouldn't have been treating this patient when it was reaching 200, not instead of actually waiting for the patient to, oh, wait, the fibrinogen is now 100. We're really behind here. But because we are using these devices, or because the quantitative blood measurement was telling you, like, you know, that this patient for a vaginal delivery has bled probably a liter, and we're not so in trouble just yet, but it's not normal. So we start being aggressive with our management. So although the quantitative blood measurement, it almost seems like it didn't help, it actually quite helped a lot, because you're actively or proactively managing the situation. And I think that similar value that's here, right? You got paged, and, you know, maybe you think that, well, maybe that page was soft, but you started treating something, you give a little bit more volume. So it happens that you're not really, really behind in the process, right? So you don't have to take that patient back. You temporize things before they actually snowball into a case that actually needs to go to the OR. So I think you bring a great amount of information. And I do see that there is, despite the low positive predictive value, there is a lot of value into being alerted to a room earlier rather than later. So let's talk about what is the future. What do you see is the future for this maternal surveillance system?
Yeah, so the future is, I think someone smarter than me will take this project forward. And to me, that's someone that really knows what they're doing with AI, I guess. To me, that's a guess, but it's somewhat of an educated guess. I think there might be a role for continuous vital sign monitoring on labor and delivery, and good interpretation, perhaps via sophisticated AI-driven algorithms of those vitals. So I'll break that apart a little bit. So continuous monitoring on OB, that's going to be a hard sell, tethering someone to a blood pressure cuff. But maybe you could convince someone to wear a device. I mean, a lot of us have a Fitbit or an Apple Watch or something nowadays, right? You could see how sophisticated continuous monitoring you could do with a wearable device. And so I think that would be interesting to see if the maternal population would be interested in putting one of these buttons or watches or something like that on. And then two, now that you're looking at it continuously, how do you interpret it? And I think, right, like these algorithms, this algorithm in particular for AWOB that we put together with the company and the multidisciplinary group, et cetera, right, was geared towards the frequency of vitals monitoring that occurred on our unit. Is it still valid if you have a continuous stream that's coming off of a watch? I don't know, And so I think AI could be potentially helpful here in my limited understanding of how it all works, right? They're very sophisticated math algorithms, and it's potential, and they offer some potential perhaps to look at, what is the patient's baseline heart rate? Is there an acute change? Is it the change in heart rate that matters? Is there some component of the algorithm that could take into effect now that you've got continuous data? And so, I don't think AI is necessarily going to be a magic bullet, but I think it's an important next step potentially to trying to move this forward.
So just to follow up on that, as technology improves and becomes more available with your experience in this field, what are your top five recommendations to utilize technology in favor of our patients?
For me, I work with tech so much that I've actually found myself taking a step back. If your computer melts, you should still be able to do your job, okay? And so when you're, like I said before, when you're dealing with a rare event, like a preventable maternal death from postpartum hemorrhage, you need to have a good amount of vigilance because that event is rare, right? And so that means you need to maintain a low threshold to evaluate any maternal concern, and that this has to be part of the whole team, right? And I think then that means to me that if you get a page from the nurse, or if you get a page, or if you have a concern expressed from a patient, or if you have a concern expressed from their family member, right, or you get an AWOB page, that you should evaluate it, that you should treat it seriously, and that, in my opinion, right, the computer here is meant to expand the tools that are already available to you. We still use our manual maternal early warning system, but we supplement it with AWOB. We supplement it with this electronic early warning system. And I think one critical piece of this is to not let the computer become a replacement for your vigilance. You have to still maintain this constant vigilance, low threshold to evaluate patients, especially when you're dealing with uncommon events, right? And I think another important takeaway of this is that you got to understand how your tools work. So like when you get a warning in your EHR, do you actually know how it's generated? Do you know the criteria that were used? And like, what are the limitations of this criteria? I think those are super important, right? So when you get an alert for something from your computer, if you don't really understand how it comes together, how do you know if you should ignore it or not? And unfortunately, a lot of us who get so many of these, the default can tend to be like, yeah, I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to move on. Okay. Right. And at least expanding this concept to AlertWatch OB, right, there are some hidden faults, I think. Right. So we're suppressing pages during the second stage of labor. What does that mean? That means that when the nurse documents 10 centimeters, until when the nurse documents delivery of the baby, you're not going to get a page, okay? So what if the nurse forgets to document delivery of the baby? And now the patient's blood pressure is actually 65 systolic. Well, you won't get a page, right? 30 minutes can go by before the managing service gets a page, right? So conceivably, you could have someone with a systolic of 65, right? If it's just a single value, if it's two consecutive values, right, then the managing service gets a page. But you could have a single isolated vital sign abnormality that just sits out there for 30 minutes until someone knows about it. And so I think that highlights that, you know, as our tools become more complicated, they can become a bit of a black box. As it becomes more of a black box, are we going to be more aware of the pitfalls of it, of some of these like hidden issues? And I think this is probably particularly true of tools that are developed using very sophisticated mathematical algorithms that will just lump into machine learning or artificial intelligence, right? And I think that because of this, it's important for us to all have a basic understanding of how your tool was developed. If you're using an AI algorithm, how was it validated? In what population was it validated? If they used a supervised method, like what were the parameters that they said would be most useful for the system and why? What parameters didn't they include? And does that affect what the algorithm spits out? You know, are there any racial or ethnic biases created by the way in which your tool was created or developed? I think that's important and something that's not always easy to detect when you're reading through these manuscripts, right? So, and then finally, like after you roll out your tool, are there still gaps? And no technology is perfect, right? Everything has an unintended consequence.
I find it actually very interesting that you end up with talking about the culture, because when you said, well, you know, what if the system fails? The first thing that I thought is that it may be very interesting to see if this system in the background has changed your institutional culture. Because if you think about it, your system has normalized the fact that at times it's actually necessary to call the obstetrician. It's necessary to call anesthesiology. Sometimes it's necessary to call both of them. So the nursing staff, the midwives, the residents, they will probably be more comfortable saying, hey, the system is down, we need to get together, something is not right here. And just that security, that safety, feeling safe in that environment of saying, hey, I'm going to put out the call because the system is down, it actually increases safety, right? And that's how I see it. So
in fact, we designed our notification systems independent of AlertWatch OB, right? So like everything we've done now, we're continuing to do, doesn't have AlertWatch OB written into the formal protocol. It's its own independent safety net so that we can try to maintain that culture of when you see something, you say something, you call it out. When you meet this threshold, you call it out. When you have any concern, you call it out. There's no mention of the pages at all. So the pages are really their own separate sort of independent safety monitoring system.
So I think that's great. I think that you're basically working on a early detection system, but also you're actually creating a new culture at your institution, which is actually definitely working in favor of your patients. So with that, I would like to end the podcast. It has been very enlightening. I actually like quite a bit the idea of the wearables. So with that, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.